This presentation about the Marxist origins of primitivism, presented by Spencer Sunshine, was delivered September 25th, 2004, at the Renewing the Anarchist Tradition Conference in Plainfield, Vermont.
Brian Oliver Shepherd isn't in the room by any chance. None of you are Brian Oliver Shepherd. I didn't want to embarrass him in front of anyone. He wrote an article on Anarcho-Syndicalist Review in spring of 2002 called An Anarcho-Syndicalist Response to Anarcho-Primitivism. And his quote is, "The primitivist fascination with primitive man is of direct descent from the liberalism of J.J. Rousseau and his adoration of the noble savage." And I picked this out because I think this is a good example of a common and pretty much complete misunderstanding of what primitivism is about and what it emerges from. I've been asked several times already at the conference if I'm a primitivist, which is the first time in my life that anyone's actually said this to me. And so I just want to say that I'm not, but I'm very interested in a lot of the contemporary on-the-ground strains of anarchism and the intellectual history of them, where they came from and what the basis of their ideas are. So when we encounter them, instead of taking them as a kind of reified form of thought, that we take their propositions and then we talk about them, we don't understand what the basis of their arguments are and how they're thinking about making these arguments. And I think especially in the case of primitivism, instead of immediately entering into some kind of argument about archaeological evidence about hunting-gathering societies or possibilities of transformation, it's more useful to think about, to get into the heads of people who are creating the theoretical background of it, because it's a highly theorized movement, and understand what the basis of their arguments are and what philosophical categories they're using as they make these arguments, because they're actually very consistent. When I tell people, or I guess I'm going to say it's 12 now, I'm going to try to speak for about 40 minutes. What do we have until, I'll try to make it 35 or 40 minutes, then we can have some Q&A. When I tell people that primitivism emerged from Marxism, I usually get one of two replies. The most common from people is disbelief. People usually think of primitivism, as I said before, this quote from Shepherd, as a kind of Rousseauian romanticism about the natural innocence of humans, and this is mixed with a kind of radical ecology that's very similar to deep ecology. The other answer you get from some people is that, of course, because two of the main primitivist theorists, Freddie Perlman and John Zerzan, all their early works are very clearly in the Marxist tradition, and these works are still in print. So if you get a copy, say, of Perlman's pamphlet, The Reproduction of Daily Life, there's a big picture of Marx and a big quote of Marx that begins and ends the pamphlet. It's not any kind of hidden thing. Zerzan's early works as well are clearly a kind of libertarian communist critique of unions. These are available in his first collection, Elements of Refusal, and other sources. I think in 1975, if you had asked the people who later became the main theorists of primitivism, and the three of them identifying here are Zerzan, David Watson, and Freddie Perlman, if they were libertarian communists, all three probably would have said yes. But by 85, all three were floating an attack on industrial civilization that we now know as primitivism. So I want to say here, as I said before, I'm not a primitivist, and nor am I a Marxist, but I think it's really worthwhile to read and consider the claims and the arguments that the theorists of both these traditions have, instead of dismissing them out of hand based on either hearsay, on vague impressions from a reading, especially of later works of people after they've already developed their ideas, and also to not dismiss their ideas based on the conduct of their followers. I mean, we've all run into Marxist cult members, and we've all run into annoying, you know, green anarchist teenagers who want to scream at you. But these are not reasons to dismiss the ideas that theorists have developed. And there's a couple other things I don't want to talk about. I don't want to talk about the validity of primitivism or Marxism. I don't want to talk about the question of agriculture. Most debates around primitivism center on four questions. One is the question of agriculture, about what it arose and its effects. The second is about the anthropological evidence regarding pre-sedentary and contemporary hunting and gathering groups. There's a separate question that a lot of people are interested in primitivism about its critique of technology. There's a large body of theoretical work about tech. A lot of it comes out of Heidegger and some of the phenomenological philosophers. And the fourth, I don't want to talk about the transformation question, about how, if one even accepted these premises, how feasible would be to try to transform a highly industrialized world with 6 billion people into a hunting-gathering style society. What I'm going to try to offer you is the most straightforward intellectual history that I could create about how this one political form emerged out of what looks like a very different political form. And it looks like it's negating it, but in reality it's a continuation of many of these same themes. This is one of the things I do a lot of work on intellectual history, and I'm very interested on how political forms are in flux and how individual members transform their ideologies, how people switch from one belief system to another, and how whole political forms themselves transform, because they're always in motion. And they look like kind of static categories. We think of anarchism or Marxism or whatever, but in reality there's all kinds of contradictions in them, there's all kinds of different themes, and they're always flowing and they're always changing. Also, this is a really complicated picture. I've been working on this project most of the year, and it's complicated for four reasons. The first is that Zerzan and some of the other primitivists actually draw from four separate but overlapping strains of Marxism. The quote from the Frankfurt School, from the Situationists, from the French and Italian ultra-left, and to a lesser extent from the tradition established by a group called the Communist Party Historians Group. And then these four strains overlap as well. The Frankfurt School and the Situationists both have a shared interest in Georges Lukács and in Hegelianism, and the Situationists and the ultra-left also have an overlapping, they're around at the same time in Europe, they also overlap in their critiques of organization and their emphasis on theory being applied to the real political activity of activists. Another reason this is difficult is that this theoretical trajectory was developed as a collaborative project between several different individual theorists and a whole collective. Perlman is in Detroit, and the Fifth Estate Collective is working on this. And then John Zerzan is living in California, and some other people are weighing in. So it's not one theorist or one person sitting down and doing research and writing a book and offering their work and then responding to criticisms. This is actually this rolling process that happens over probably about 10 years. And in fact, some of the main articles in the development of primitivism have happened as responses. Someone wrote an article, and then people debated it in letters columns, and people wrote responses, which then ended up being articles. So there's a very fluid motion to it, and it's very reactionary in a sort of way, that people aren't sitting back and studying something, they're reacting to comments. And there's also a third question about European influences, because a lot of these libertarian communists in the U.S. in the early 70s were reading a lot of these ultra-leftists and situationists and the Frankfurt School coming out of Europe, and many of the texts were just being translated, so it's often unclear, even if they cite someone or there's an influence, what texts were available, what texts were published in English and available in the U.S., and also, of course, some of these people are multilingual, which theorists they could read and then which documents they actually could get hold of. So it becomes a kind of tricky question to separate, but I'm going to do my best. I'm going to concentrate on Zerzan. There's actually different versions, fairly different versions of primitivism between the one developed by David Watson, and in many ways this project is continued by the current Fifth Estate Collective, although the current editor of the paper, Sunfrog, embraces what he calls an ecumenical anarchism. There is certainly there's still an anti-civilization current within that, but they're not very dominant in the movement now. The movement, which mostly goes under the term green anarchism, this term used to include social ecology, but now it's been kind of rewritten with primitivism at its core, but this primitivism is also highly dominated by John Zerzan's version, which is very different than the other versions. And so Zerzan's thought has become very influential on the ground political actors. It's been an influence on the Unabomber, on the Black Bloc actions in Seattle during the anti-WTO demonstrations, and currently I'm sure he has a fair amount of influence within people in the ELF. There's another problem that almost all the major proponents of primitivism have died, repudiated, or become fascists. Richard Hunt, who formed the English Green Anarchist magazine after the Gulf War, actually embraced fascism and moved to the right, formed a magazine called Alternative Green, which is fed into a weird offshoot of the white nationalist movement called National Anarchism, where currently they're a post-third position white nationalists who are trying to recruit anarchists. But leaving that, we'll leave that. It's another very interesting movement. Freddie Perlman and Bob Brubaker both died. Perlman died in 85 and Brubaker in the early 90s. David Watson, Jason McQuinn, who's the editor of Anarchy Magazine, he also writes under Lev Chernyi, and Stephen Booth all repudiated primitivism. And then John Moore repudiated primitivism and then died. So there's been another thing I want to leave aside is there's been a tumultuous history of primitivism in England around Green Anarchist magazine. Stuart Home got involved in denouncing this group. There's been a controversy between the Americans and John Moore, and then the UK state got involved and sued the editors, attempted to jail them under the Gandalf trial. Does anyone remember this in the mid-90s? It's the Green Anarchist and ALF. They arrested all the editors and some ALF members, and there was a big show trial. There's a lot of this material's online if you want to explore the English anarchist, English primitivist debates. So I guess, do people here have a fairly clear idea about what primitivism is, or is there anyone who doesn't? Could you? All right, I'm going to skip over Teresa Kintz's definition of it then. I'm going to give you a brief background about John Zerzan. I became interested in this. I have a friend who's a longtime Wobbly who told me that Zerzan, I haven't confirmed this, but Zerzan was a Wobbly in the 70s. Zerzan was a Wobbly in the 70s? And he's like, yeah, you should go back and read his own stuff. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. He was born in 43 and grew up in Oregon. He went to Stanford between 61 and 66, and he actually ended up hanging out with Neil Cassidy and Ken Kesey. He went to a bunch of the early acid tests, took LSD and saw the Grateful Dead. He was in a colloquium with Alexander Kerensky. Kerensky, of course, was the premier of the Russian Provisional Government between March and October of 1917, this period after the Tsar, before the Bolsheviks had a coup d'etat. After he finished school, he moved to San Francisco and hung out in Haight-Ashbury. There's a constant theme about all the things primitivists denounce now, Zerzan did. He got arrested doing CD at an anti-war demo in 66 and spent 15 days in jail. He got a job with the state working in the Department of Social Services, and from 66 to 61 helped form a dual alternative union called the San Francisco Social Services Employees Union, which is the object of the flyer I passed out. It was a very radical and bottom-up union that the workers themselves controlled, but he held the position of vice president in 68 and president of a union in 69. He also says that he was in a local of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union, as well as in the Teamsters. I think at the time, he said that he considered himself a Maoist. He said this when he spoke in London in 2000. And SSEU followed a strategy called the Long March Through the Institutions, where the radicals were supposed to enter into the institutions in our society and radicalize them from within. Another thing that he really hates now. In 70, he learns about the Situationists and is influenced by them, but their influence doesn't creep into his theory till later. He gets a master's at San Francisco State in history from 71 to 72. From 72 to 5, he's in LA and is doing PhD work at the University of Southern California, but he quits before doing his dissertation. He moves back to San Francisco and starts writing with Fifth Estate. He himself says he's always interested in what he calls labor studies and social control, and this is very important for why he moved from being a critic of unions to a critic of symbolic thought. He drinks a lot, and at one point takes all his furniture out of his apartment and burns it. In 81, he moves back to Oregon, settles in Eugene, and starts doing his the kind of work that people are probably familiar with now. In 1988, he splits with Fifth Estate over arguments about theoretical positions, and he moves to Anarchy Magazine. He's currently a contributing editor of Anarchy Magazine, and he's also on the editorial staff of Green Anarchy, the Eugene magazine. After the Unabomber case and the WTO, he gains a lot of popular media attention. And there's a lot of other things like Robles Ricos, who's, I believe, is still in jail, and Free and Critter, all people in Eugene who are around the scene in the Whitaker neighborhood that he is close to in many ways. Also, an interesting thing I found out, his cousin, Catherine, was a member of the Weather Underground. I don't think this has ever been mentioned anywhere. But she used to work in an info shop that I worked at on the West Coast, and people, I think I can say this publicly, she was pretty open about it. So that's another kind of influence on why he takes this, I think, ultra-radical position is the influence of his cousin, who's, I think, he's pretty close to. Okay, so the switch is this. Zerzan moves from being a critic of unions, basically a pro-working class, revolutionary leftist critic of unions to a critic, and he's critiquing unions because he believes that they are an instrument of social control, to critique what he believes are all different things that are instruments of social control, which he eventually ends up considering any kind of symbolic thought. if you think about this, it's not Rousseauian at all, and it really has nothing to do with ecology. It's a kind of humanism. And he's very interested in what is, what are the things that alienate us and mediate us from the world? And this is a classic theme that he picks up from the Frankfurt School, as well as the Situationist. All people coming out of a Hegelian reading of Marxism and concentrating on the critique of mediation. So he's, remember, he's political enough to get arrested in 66 at a demo, but his first of what's called the Origins Essays, he has five essays on time, language, art, number, and agriculture. They're published between 83 and 88 in Fifth Estate. They're called the Origins Essays. Before he publishes the first one, he's published almost 20 scholarly articles. So there's a whole body of work that he's done before coming to these critiques of symbolic forms. And many of his early essays are co-written by his wife, Paula, and then she drops off of the citations later. I think she asked to be removed from them, but he always thanks her, if you look closely. He's got two kinds of early essays. The first is, and he still does this stuff, it's a rapid-fire list of all the ills in the world, and it really is, there's some critiques of Zerzan as a kind of, he says he hates postmodernism, but he himself embodies a lot of the traits of what we consider this, like, quickly moving, fragmented, you know, images and themes that characterize postmodernism. So one, an example from in The Promise of the 80s, which is published in Fifth Estate in 80, he calls the world a place of complete demoralization and unrelieved sadness. And he cites the following evidence. These are all citations from published articles. Insomnia, depression, teenage drinking, drug use, childhood suicide rate, this is a favorite citation of his, senility, tranquilizer use and stress, he's addicted to tranquilizers at the time, a lack of trust in leaders and societal institutions, general pessimism and malaise, loss of job satisfaction, lie detector tests, decline in voting, school truancy, decrease in reading and writing skills, school revolts, arson, troubles in New York, snipers, urban riots, high absentee rates and turnover, on-the-job sabotage, and he goes on and on. He ends with the falseness of trading away one's life in order to purchase things is a transparently barren death trip. His other essays at the same time are fairly somber critiques of how unions function to restrain workers' desires for self-management. He's very into really classic syndicalist themes of worker self-management. And about ultimately he decides that the main problem with technology is it acts further to stop workers' abilities from seizing control over the productive processes and thereby from enacting control over their own lives. Remember, while he's publishing these, he's been the president of a union local and also the former member of at least three unions. His first article in 1972, in fact, is a critique of Cesar Chavez and the farm workers, saying that their entrance of the farm workers into the UFW, the United Farm Workers Union, and their signing of exclusive bargaining contracts actually works to deflate worker radicalism. In this essay, we can already see five main themes he returns to again. One, that unions deflate worker radicalism. Two, that they allow the management to control the workers. Three, that workers become spectators rather than participants in their own lives. This is a classic situationist theme. Four, that political representation in the form of a union bureaucracy is inherently non-radical. And five, that in the whole process, the worker becomes alienated just another time, but this time by a union. A union that is allied with the employee, with the employer and the state, and this becomes later the Frankfurt and other in situ conception of the totality. So it's this big, all these social forces are in alignment and creating one big homogenous system of control over individuals in which some kind of locus of resistance for the resistance to the system of control has to be posited. His second article is on the National Civic Federation, which was a group early part of the century in which the AFL, under Samuel Gompers, cooperated with some businesses in this kind of like everyone sit down and get together and be friendly to each other. But in this essay, he argues that the real reason the AFL did this was to suppress the radicals, and in particular the IWW. So in his second essay, the hero of his essay is the IWW, and now like syndicalists give him Tourette's. So here's one of the first parts of Marxism that he picks up on, and this is the influence of the Communist Party Historians Group. They were a very interesting group in England in the 50s, I believe, and they included people like Christopher Hill, Eric Hobsbawm, and E.P. Thompson. Their influence is seen in the U.S. on historians like Howard Zinn. They stressed the need to write history from below, from the perspective of excluded groups, of the workers, of the illiterate. This work's had a lot of influence on things like people who try to create narratives from slaves' perspectives, all kinds of people doing women's history, all kinds of people have been written out of the histories. This is an attempt to put them back in. And so at one point, Zerzan says that his real calling was to be a historian, and a lot of his works on unions can be seen as written, trying to write history. The labor histories get written from the union's perspectives, but since the unions are working against the interests of the workers, he's trying to write from the workers' perspectives in from labor histories. And then later, you can even see his attempt to create accounts of pre-sedentary, pre-agricultural life as another way of trying to write this kind of suppressed history that's conspicuous more by its absence than anything else. His third article was published in the prestigious journal Telos. Are people here familiar with the Telos journal? Does anyone not? Raise your hand if you're not. Okay. Telos was a very important journal in the 70s because they were Frankfurt School Marxism. Who here is not familiar with Frankfurt School Marxism? Over a bit. They were forwarding a lot of the English translations at the time. Very little of this had been translated then. It became very popular in academia and the more highly theorized Marxist circles in the 70s and into the 80s. And currently, for example, Dialectic of Enlightenment wasn't translated into English until 72. And in Telos, they were publishing all these translations of Lukács. I think Arendt was being published in there. I can't remember. No, she was in the U.S. So this is like the heroic period of Telos. Telos has since moved to the right. And he has an article published in there in 74 that's called the Organized Labor versus the Revolt Against Work. And this becomes a wildly popular article. It's reprinted several times in the U.S. It's reprinted in a pamphlet called Unions Against Revolution with an essay by Jean Muniz. It's still in print on Red and Black. You can order a copy from Lorraine if you send her a couple bucks. It gets translated into a lot of languages. People are interested in this because at the time there's an interest in the left in what becomes called the revolt against work. Remember, in 1973 is this famous year for Marxists who are working, especially in the vein of Frederick Jameson or David Harvey, and Hart and Negri also pick up on this a lot. It's when there's a shift from Fordism to post-Fordism. It's when the dollar is taken off the gold standard. And there's this crisis a crisis of productivity, and this is supposed to represent a shift from Fordism, from this factory system with high levels of income being paid to workers, where people then spend the money in the consumer society, to flexible accumulation, where we find this move towards jobs no longer having permanence, towards having permatemps for everything, for people being expected to retrain themselves all the time and constantly move around and follow flows of capital. So despite this economic crisis, there's a whole huge amount of spontaneous workers and actions that are happening outside of the union. There's wildcat strikes, there's factory occupations, there's sabotage on the production lines, there's something called job swapping, where workers in heavy industry plants, actually, they want to have breaks, so they have one person do two jobs at once and they take a break. There's worker slowdowns, and there's high levels of worker absenteeism. And these people all read this as, so there's an economic crisis, but people aren't afraid of keeping their jobs. They're like, fuck this, we don't want to, they're reading it that as a turning of people's back on this way of working, and on especially factories, and on the kind of way that work is set up in our society. Because of this interest, and this is an interest by the ultra left, do people here know what the ultra left is? Raise your hand if you don't know what the ultra left is. Are good. Okay.
Anybody who's to my left.
What?
Anybody who's to my left.
I'll do a quick review. The ultra leftists are people are Marxists, and this tradition is strong in Italy and France, who they don't like any of the really existing communist states. They're not Trotskyists, they're not Maoists, and they're not Stalinists. They come very close to syndicalism and council. Many of them think of themselves in the council communist tradition. Some of them embrace Lenin and some of them don't. One of the ultra-left currents that's existent today is the Italian autonomous tradition that's represented by Hart and Negri. And out of autonomy in Italy comes zero work, and this stuff is all coming, I've been trying to figure this out, this all is coming out of this interest in the cities again about the revolt against work. Zerzan, seeing evidence that there's collusion between unions, the business, and the state, he cites a Times article which claims that Nixon in 72 offered to put union officials at a high level in every federal government in exchange for their loyalty. So he's seeing this big constellation of all these main institutions in our society, like coming together to form a joint pact against the workers. And he continues with this theory. He cites a Department of Labor article which implies the inevitability of total unionization. He only gives up on this theory after Reagan busts the air traffic controller strike in 81. Remember in 80, the Teamsters endorsed Reagan as their candidate. The ultra-left, which includes Italian autonomists, also includes French groups like the Situationist International, Socialism of Barbary, the ICO, and neo-Bordigaists like Jacques Camus. And so he's coming out of this tradition most clearly early on. One of his influences I've been able to confirm is a guy named Henri Simon, Henry Simon, and he's in a group called the ICO. And he champions spontaneous organization. He, in an essay called On Organization, he makes a division between two kinds of organizations, spontaneous organizations, just people, workers who without any form suddenly rise up and engage in social movements, especially strikes and slowdowns and such. He cites the 53 East Berlin Workers' Uprising, the Meijin Uprisings in Paris in 68, the Swedish Ironworkers' Strike in 69-70, the 73 Lip Strike in France, the 74 British Miners' Strike, the Polish Insurrection of 76, the rioting during the 77 blackout in New York, and other forms like this. So people are seeing a lot of worker militancy at a time that it's all happening outside of the unions, it's all happening outside of the political parties, it's all happening outside of vanguard parties, and it's happening outside of anarchist groups. Workers are just engaging in this automatically. And with this championing of non-organizational social movements, there also becomes a kind of praise of the spontaneity and self-creation of workers themselves, and this becomes almost it becomes an important ontological point for them, but it becomes something that they start fetishizing. And in Marxism, there's a long discussion starting with Rosa Luxemburg and going into this about, do you use the party to create revolution, or do you trust the spontaneous workers' organization? So this has always been a theme. It runs through all the council communists, and they kind of go back and forth. And so at this point, they're like, fuck it, all organizational forms are bad. Trust the spontaneous, self-generated action of the workers. If you want to see some more about this, there's a document created in 78 in French that's translated into English in 79 that the ICP, Simone's group, the ICO, Henri Simon's group, called the Refusal of Work, Facts and Discussions, that Zurzin, it's an exchange of letters between European ultra-leftists, and Zurzin also participates in it. It's very turgid if you can get through it. I tried several times. It's available online at the Collective Action Notes website if you want to look at it. But if you have any questions about Zurzin's status as a Marxist, look at this. It's just cool. Another main influence from the ultra-left is Jacques Camus. If you're interested about the intellectual history of primitivism, I urge everyone to read Camus. He's I don't know how fascinating he is on his own, but I read it and I was like, oh, like Camus lays out the entire project in the early 70s, and all these people take off on him. Zurzin himself says he doesn't like him, but Freddie Perlman and David Watson, who are developing primitivism alongside Zurzin, are highly influenced by him, and Zurzin ends up adopting all Camus' critiques.
How do you spell it?
C-A-M-A-T-T-E. There's the Mayday table has a couple of the pamphlets, Wandering of Humanity, and I think the AK table has those, as Tana Media also has the one anthology in English of his. It's called The Wandering of Humanity and Other Essays. Camus has four basic points that the future primitivists pick up on. He has a critique of rackets. It's often attributed to him, but it actually comes out of the Frankfurt School. Horkheimer's talking about rackets in the 40s. Rackets he defines as any kind of, it can be an economic group or it can be a political group. Any economic or political structure which wields power and excludes other can compromise a racket. And so theory can be a racket. If I say, if we have a discussion and I know more theory than you do and I exclude you from it, I can make decisions, that's a racket. Any kind of structured organization is a racket. A racket can be political. This is a heresy to Marxism, because a racket can be political or economic. And this is at one point where people point at the Frankfurt School and say, you guys have actually walked outside of Marxism if you're saying a political structure can be independent of an economic structure. So there's a total refusal of any organizational form. Now, Kamat himself says this isn't a kind of Stirnerite individualism. This is a unbridled trust in the spontaneity of the workers. And a part of this is, from the ultra-left perspective, is that they're Marxists and they continue to utilize a Marxist critique, but they see all of the existing Marxist projects as failures. They totally repudiate what all the statist Marxists have done. And so it's a kind of last-ditch attempt to keep Marxism, but to give it a kind of praxis. Another important, as you said, there's rackets, there's refusal of organizations, and Kamat is very long, I encourage you to read him, but another main theory that he has that people use is called the takeoff of capitalism and the wandering of humanity. He says that the labor theory of value that Marx relies on no longer holds, and this is very important, because if the labor theory of value no longer holds, then the working class is no longer important as a locus of revolutionary change. The working class in Marx, of course, is the class that can create revolutionary change because they're the people who work on the world, and this creates value. But if this is no longer important, then many other groups can be the locus of revolutionary change. Women can be the locus of revolutionary change, students, countercultural groups, ecological groups. You see a different form of this in third world Marxism, where they start trying to, like, you know, pick the group that will make the revolution and kind of go around in a circle. And he argues that Marx predicted that the system would transform itself when the productive forces had reached a certain level, but this obviously hadn't happened. So people are like, maybe the productive forces aren't developed enough, or maybe they're developed too much. He, following Bordiga, an Italian left communist who quarreled with Gramsci, says that they cite Marx from both the Communist Manifesto of 1844, as well as some of his later work on the Russian agrarian question, and, well, especially the Manifesto. They say, well, if Marx said that communism was possible in 1844, and it's clear that the capitalist, you know, productive forces hadn't developed enough then maybe communism is possible at any point, and we can just jump immediately from wherever our situation is into communism, and this has always been a historical possibility. So at any point, people could have moved from where they were, you know, in this teleological and linear progression that Marx sees that history moves in. We could have jumped out of time and into communism. This is called invariance, and Kamat's journal is called invariance. Also, but he sees that capital has taken off. It's no longer beholden to the labor theory of value. It's clear that the system hasn't transformed itself. And so something else is going on, but because of this takeoff, the working class is no longer important, but there's now been a kind of shift. So there's power now stands above people who are standing at the bottom. In Marx, there's a dialectical relationship between capital and the workers, right? Capital is in the embodiment of dead labor, and the actual laborers themselves are the workers, so there's a dialectical relationship. But after the takeoff of capital, this relationship has been split. So now there's a big system that's standing above workers and other people, everyone at the bottom, in opposition. And you're going to find the same theory in Negri with the idea of the multitude versus the empire, and you're also going to find a similar theory in Bookchin. It's again a form of dualism, a kind of us versus them, but it's one that decenters work and labor as being important. So what this does is it provides an opportunity for people who are thinking of themselves as Marxists, and still working through Marxist theory, it gives them a door to walk outside of Marxism. I mean, I think Marxism should be thought of as a really weird kind of religion. And this is like, it's like the Pope issuing an encyclical allowing Catholics to abandon their religion. It's basically, I think, how Kamat functions for people. It certainly looks that it was used that way by people like Freddie Perlman and David Watson, who thought of themselves as libertarian communists, and they used it as a way to exit, to justify to themselves in the way they've been thinking, to exit their perspective and to do a shift like this. Zerzan does it. Zerzan's actually very consistent in his critique of mediation. What he does, these people make a thing like this. And so Watson at one point in the Swamp Fever essay will claim that it's duplicitous, it's false to say that primitivism emerged from libertarian communism. And it's true. Once he leaves it, he really does leave it. He doesn't keep the categories. Zerzan takes a bunch of different strains of Marxism, takes these themes and pulls them in this very, like, kind of consistent way over about 30 years. He's still talking about the same themes now he was talking about in the early 70s. he doesn't do this kind of shift. He remains consistent, whereas the others do a kind of, they like fold themselves inside out, is how I see it. There's two other things I'll talk about, and then let's open this up for Q&A. One is the question of the self. So Zerzan, Watson and Perlman keep Kamat. Zerzan says he doesn't like him, but he keeps his critique of organization. This is why primitivists and green anarchists reject any of the federation, you know, structures that have been floated around in the last 10 years. Or any other real kind of, they tend to, all the green anarchists and primitivists I've been around tend to deny any attempt to, you know, sometimes even have process at meetings or things. They want things just to happen, you know, organically and naturally. Part of this is tied into the conception of the self. Were there any questions about Kamat and Zerzan? Should I go on? I thought it was a little incoherent. I'll go on, you can call me on it later. Is it a different conception of the self that exists in Zerzan and in Perlman, for that matter, than the classical Marxist formation? It comes from several sources, the European ultra-left and the Sitchus, and also from Nietzsche and Reich. Kamat says a really interesting thing. He talks about when Marx in the Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts of 1844 defines our species being what we are ontologically, what makes us humans, as being defined by work and the work process. Our ability to do work and our working on the world is the central defining point of what makes us human. Kamat uses a kind of historical materialist critique that Marx develops to critique Marx himself, and he says, look, what Marx is saying is not so much a kind of ahistorical truth about humanity as much as it is a product of his own time, this obsession of capitalism about work, and Marx repeats the same obsession about work and makes it central to humans. So Marx himself is embodying capitalist values with his whole schema. In its place, Kamat says that despite the pernicious effects of capital, quote, an irreducible element has continued to allow human beings to revolt against the oppression of capital. So what we get in the primitivists is the switch. I call it the ontological switch that happens with a lot of groups and a lot of Marxist-influenced groups in the 60s, from productivity being a central ontological category to an ecstatic and creative self that then can resist this big totalizing system that stands outside of us. And so the problem becomes that the system is totalizing, and we're totally mediated, and everyday life has been completely colonized by the commodity form. This is a Du Bois quote that Lefebvre picks up on. You know, how can we resist this if we're internalizing, you know, the dialectical dialectical materialism says that we reach out into the world and we internalize the world, right? There's very little that we don't really have an innate self. We are the product of our social and historical circumstances, so we're always taking the world into us. This is Marx's earlier, more Hegelian-influenced critique of materialism. It becomes kind of more base superstructure later on. But that's a frozen form of this. So if there's this whole system that's, speaking in this one, univocal voice about the world as it exists, as the world as it always exists, and power relations are just natural, then how is there resistance? And so there's resistance because there's an ecstatic and creative self that always wants to rebel against this. This is much more, this is partly from Reich, but this is heavily from Nietzsche. So you're going to find a shift to Nietzscheanism with a lot of these thinkers. The situationists are the main people who champion this idea. How the Americans read the situationists in this regard is that there's an ecstatic and creative self that innately knows its desire. There's a lot of ideas about innate desire. And so there's this totalizing system that they call, or Du Bois calls, the spectacle, right? And the resistance to the spectacle happens when people get in touch with this kind of innate desire, and there's going to be this grand moment of refusal where everyone says no to the system and puts a stop to things. This is how the situationists get read. I actually had it. I met a former member of the Situationist International the other week, and I brought some of this stuff up because it's the work I'm doing. I was like, well, what do you think about this? And he's like, that's not what we were saying at all. We thought of ourselves as revolutionary communists, as solidly in the Marxist tradition. Now, I know people read it that way, but it's not. That's not what we meant. So don't take this as what the Board of Anajim or others were saying, but this is how it got interpreted in the U.S. And again, there's a lot of problems about what material is available in the U.S. It comes into English slowly through the 70s, and a lot of the early translations are said to be very bad. Christopher Gray's Leaving the 20th Century is often said to be a terrible translation as well. As Freddie Perlman made the first translation of Society of the Spectacle in 70, but I guess he disliked it so much in 77, he made another one. And there's actually two more translations that are available now by Donald Nicholson Smith in 94, made one, and Ken Knob has a new translation of it on site. So in the context of Kamat's idea about the real domination of capital, you know, which is this capital's taken off, and it combines it with a kind of a Foucauldian biopolitics, and it's physically, it's no longer just exploiting our labor value, it's controlling our very own lives, and it's like, you know, capital works to control the life process now, and that's its main function. And in opposed to that is an uncontaminated self that resists domination, and at this point is why it looks like Rousseau to a lot of people. It looks like this is pure self that's natural and innate. But they get, and it does come to the same point, and Zurzen later will be into Rousseau. I believe he includes him on one of his two anthologies of other people's work. And I believe it's in the first one, Against Civilization. It's out of print, but it's online if you look around for it. So they do get to Rousseau, but they're not coming from Rousseau. They're coming really from this Marxist, this long Marxist discussion about worker spontaneity. Perlman combines this idea later with Reich's idea of character armor, when he creates this idea of Leviathan that's in Against History, Against Leviathan. And there he says the history is the history of rackets, of economic and political rackets. These rackets socialize us. We internalize our own oppression. We internalize the racket's own ideology and character armor, which is this kind of layer. Reich is working through all this Freudian stuff and combining it with Marx. It's kind of layer that's part of us, but it's the social self and it's not the true self, but we can break the character armor. Reich recommends the vegetotherapy, which is apparently some kind of chiropractic, before he moves on to organ theory to break the character armor. So Perlman combines Reich and rackets to make Leviathan. Against History, Against Leviathan is a somewhat interesting book. It's one of the more cited anarchist works from the last 50 years. If you're going to read his stuff, if you've never read him, I really love his essays on the reproduction of daily life, which he prints in 69, which is about how structures are not imposed on us, but we build structures up through our everyday actions. I think especially if people are doing work around gender and sexual behavior oppression involving these topics, I think like you can see it most clearly that way. That, you know, homophobia is not something that the state legislates and there's people here with guns, you know, sometimes there are people there with guns, but it's something that we produce in our jailing actions, and we build structures up through how we, when we get up and we behave each day, that is how an institution arises. Bourdieu will pick up on this, and Anthony Giddens, an English sociologist, will do this, and he calls it structuration. But it's the same idea. So the last theme in Zurzen is that he uses, and this is the tool that he uses to move from a critique of unions to a critique of symbolic representation, is three interlinking topics, and they're totalization, mediation, and subject-object reconciliation. Excuse me. These are all themes that come out of the Western Marxist tradition via Hegel. And specific here, these themes are developed by Georges Lukacs, by Adorno and Horkheimer, by Marcuse, and by Debord. One of the more controversial elements of Hegel's thought is its emphasis on totality. On one hand, this is good because it always keeps the oneness of the world in the forefront of things. We have a tendency to take things out of context and to try to say in the social sciences, people want to observe a situation, you know, they observe a situation in society and they make a big model of it and they say, look, this is how this process works. And it's like, you know, no, this is how the process works when you observed it, you know, in this culture at this time. You're suppressing the movement of time and the flow of the world in doing this, and you're taking it away from a whole bigger thing. So totality in Hegel says you always got to understand that everything is interlinked, and that everything is part of this one kind of unified whole, and don't break it up. Don't break it up into fragments. Capitalism breaks our life up into fragments. Don't repeat that. Don't repeat that fragmentation. On the other hand, totality becomes problematic because it collapses differences and makes universal claims about local occurrences. I guess in the same way that I was just talking about. The problem is, for a lot of Hegelian Marxists, is they take a specific circumstance and they conflate it and they make it universal and they make it cover everything to try to fit into this structure of totality. So here specifically they'll take mediation and they'll make mediation total over everything, or they'll take unions, the state, and employers, and they'll make it this total system. So there's this tendency to want to totalize stuff that maybe isn't so totalizing, or I don't think it is. There's also mediation. Hegel says that mediation is part and parcel of the dialectical process. For example, in the Lordship and Bondsman or the Master-Slave Dialectic, it's the bondsman who always mediates between the master and the world that's worked on. But all these mediating forms and these dialectical processes are all interlinked with each other. So, like, at the same time, the bondsman is mediated by labor. Between the bondsman and the world, the mediation is labor. So Lukács is building off of this. He takes Marx's analysis of the commodity form, the section, the fetishism of the commodity and its secret, which is in the fourth part of chapter one of Capital, and he blows it up into a concept called reification. This is in the History and Class Consciousness anthology. Reification, the technical meaning of the term is to mistake an abstraction for reality. So my concept of a coat, I take, instead of seeing a real coat that's in front of me, I'm thinking coat, and I treat it like a coat instead of interacting with the real object that's in front of me. Lukács uses the term to say the commodity form blinds people, and we can no longer see that commodities are just the embodiment of our own dead labor. We can't see that. We look around and we see this world, and we see it as like a foreign alien object, and we can no longer see that that's not an alien object, that world is us. We built that world, and it's not something else. We can't see that everything in the world is part of an ongoing and flowing dialectical process. Time also appears dead. In dialectics, there's a large emphasis on temporality, flux, and change. And Lukács says that capitalism makes time seem to be dead. It suppresses the dialectical flow of things. So we forget about that humans create the world, and we forget that everything's always changing. And so this is because commodities are so ever-present in our lives that it seems like the production of commodities has been the way that humans have always... Capitalism is the only form of social organization that's ever existed, and humans have always produced commodities because we see them everywhere. And the idea that there can be a non-commodity-producing society is forgotten, or that most humans never did produce commodities. Remember now, Marx defined your commodity as an item that can be exchanged on a market. So it's not just making things. It's actually making things that have a price, essentially that have a price on them, that you can buy and sell. Du Bois takes the idea of reification, he transforms it into his idea of spectacle. It's like the next level of reification is spectacle. He claims that with the advent of the consumer society, reality becomes replaced by its image. All that was once directly lived has become mere representation, he says in the second sentence of Society and the Spectacle. He says it doesn't just happen in the West, that it's universal. He says it happens in Africa and in the East and socialist countries. It's got a distinction between concrete and diffuse spectacle. What are his two? He's got two different things. It's in the later part of Society and Spectacle. And he'll claim that there's really no outside of this, that this is a totalizing mediation. The resistance, again, comes from this innate ecstatic self that has innate desires that can overturn the system. Everyday life has become totally colonized by the commodity form. Adorno and Horkheimer, who are also, and he's building off of Lukács, and if you read, Du Bois always champions the workers' councils. He's a council communist. I mean, he takes this from Lukács, who also is championing the workers' councils early on, before he kind of has to kowtow to Lenin. And he champions the party at the very end of History and Class Consciousness. But this is a change. Adorno and Horkheimer are also influenced by Lukács. They see that with the advent of mass culture, everything is moving towards a homogenized totality. In the 30s, they see a conjunction of all three really existing political systems: liberal capitalism under the New Deal, fascism under Hitler's corporatism, and communism under Stalin, as all versions of state capitalism. So again, just like Zurzon sees the alignment of unions, the state, in Capital, Frankfurt School are seeing the same like triadic alignment of all systems becoming the same thing. Later, when they see the emerging post-war mass culture, they proclaim that standardized culture makes standardized humans. They do this because they're using a form of Hegelian materialism, that if we're taking the world and internalizing it, and suddenly we have this mass culture where everything is mass-produced and it's all bad sugar Hollywood pop songs, and we are what we're exposed to, then we are that. Adorno ends up, at the end of the 60s, proclaiming almost literally that the world is lost, and our only hope to even glance at possibilities which lay beyond it are to be found in very obscure high-culture avant-garde art. Not that you can even see the world then, but only in this very rarefied, high lofty heights. Remember, he's teaching at Columbia. Like, only then can we even glance that there's something, you know, this art lets us know that there's something over there. It doesn't let us look at it, it just lets us know that there's something over there. So, people who think Zerzan is negative, you know, should go back and read the Dialectic of Enlightenment again. I mean, it's this eschatological critique of the world just being shit. Marcuse will make a similar claim that Adorno and Horkheimer do about mass culture and one-dimensional man. This book's probably the most influential theoretical text of the 60s, and it encompasses most of Zerzan's analysis. If you read it, you'll see many of his themes in there, from psychoanalysis to mediation, from the critique of technology to the critique of a totally mediated society. I'll give you a citation from the introduction of it. Marcuse says that in the face of the totalitarian feature of this society, the traditional notion of the neutrality of technology can no longer be maintained. Technology as such cannot be isolated from the use to which it's put. Zerzan always says this, tech is not neutral, tech is always bad. It hides itself by saying it's neutral. The technological society is a system of domination which operates already in the concept and construction of techniques. And in the medium of technology, culture, politics, and economy merge into an omnipresent system which swallows up or repulses all alternatives. So you can't work through the system to change it. The system recuperates any attempt to work through it. You have to overturn the whole thing. Mediation in all these thinkers becomes not just part of life, but a totality. Zerzan, who started thinking about unions as a form of mediation, now sees mediation everywhere, and he conflates it with technology. And the first time he does this is an essay called Industrialism and Domestication, which is published in Fifth Estate in 77. I read it and I didn't notice this. It just looked like his usual critique of unions, and it was talking about Luddites, I think, and the introduction of machinery. But what it does is he points out that the introduction of technology is something that always makes it harder and harder for workers to control the production process. If we're all using computers at our co-op and we want to make a completely different society, like, we're going to be dependent on the use of computers as part of what we're doing. As long as we get this more stratified and more complex technological system, the ability of us to actually control our own lives moves further and further and further away. Zerzan will define technology as a pivot in mediation. In Future Primitivism, his collection Future Primitivism, Primitive, he finds it this way. He says, technology is the ensemble of the division of labor, production, and industrialization, and its impact on us and nature. Technology is the sum of mediations between us and the natural world, and the sum of those separations mediating us from each other. It is all the drudgery and toxicity required to produce and reproduce the stage of hyper-alienation we languish in. It's the texture and form of domination at any given stage of hierarchy and commodification. So Zerzan here is continuing the classic Western Marxist discussion that's called subject-object reconciliation. It runs through Bloch and Lukács and Adorno and Marcuse. It's the discussion about mediation. It's can we heal the division between the subject and object? Hegel, of course, says you can't really do it, and we stop at the state that the liberal state always kind of has to. It's not even the liberal state, he's thinking of the Prussian state in the early 1800s, it's hardly a liberal state. We can never really branch this divide, so the state has to mediate us. And Marx has often argued, says that communism is a form of the last chapter in Phenomenology of Spirit about absolute knowledge, that it's the point where humans, and you'll see this in Bookchin as well, can get to the point where we can understand this whole process and be able to champion it and to control it and to make a rational world, that we can heal the subject-object division. this becomes questioned because a lot of these Marxists initially were Leninists and championed the Soviet Union. They see the Soviet Union still, you know, looks, Stalin looks like he's carrying out Marxism, and they don't understand. It's clear that everyday life is very alienated in the Soviet Union, and so they start to wonder if this reconciliation is ever possible, if we ever can live in an unmediated world. And so Zerzan is simply really just continuing this discussion. But while everyone else basically gives up on it, Zerzan stays very wedded to the idea. This is his interest in hunting-gathering societies, is he sees them as, he believes some anthropological claims that I think have more to do with the observers than the observed, about that, about how people in non-agricultural societies seem to be totally unmediated from the world, and that this was also a possibility. Then he looks back and projects it looking backwards, about what the lives of pre-agricultural and especially pre-linguistic humans must have been like. So he says, we're not going to give up on subject-object reconciliation. We can live in an unmediated world. Our world is totally mediated now, but we can't go forward to it, so we have to go back. I'm going to leave it at that. If people are interested, I can tell you later that the philosophical problems with what he's doing, but yeah.